Hello, welcome to this podcast of the European Survey Research Association. My name is Vera Tupul, and today we're going to talk about how to make surveys more enjoyable. We have seen falling response rates in the last couple of decades. We have seen that more and more people are doing surveys, so it is more difficult to stand out of the crowd. So it is important to think about how to make surveys more enjoyable to make sure that people are completing your surveys. And with me today are two experts in the field. A lot of experience is here, so I'm really looking forward to what these two guys have to say about how to make surveys more enjoyable. My first guest is John Poulston. He is a vice president of innovation at Kantar and one of the most proclaimed market researchers working on industry today. He has done groundbreaking research when it comes to, for example, gamification, and also his work on how to design surveys that engage respondents more effectively is very much pronounced. Welcome, John.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm glad to be here.
Yes, glad to have you. And my other guest is Niels Schillewaert. He is co-founder and managing partner at Insights Consulting. And Niels combines entrepreneurship and commercial research with academic research. He was a professor of marketing at the Vlerick Business School, and he has published in leading scientific journals and is the former president of ASOMAR, which is the Association of the Global Insights Community. Welcome, Niels.
Thank you, Vera. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Everything you said about John is true.
Well, now we're looking to John to say the same, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Niels works for one of my favorite companies, actually, in the market research industry. They're so innovative from top to bottom. From the every presentation they produce imbues the story of engagement, I think, and all their techniques. So, I've seen some of their, some of the outputs of what they do. So, yes, I actually recommended Niels to come along to this event, because I'm really impressed with what they do. They live and breathe this idea of thinking about the person doing a survey as a human being who you have to think about how to engage how to communicate with and so on in an effective way.
So, John, I think when we first met, which is probably more than a decade ago, you were working on gamification.
Mm.
So can you tell a little bit more about how gamification can help to make surveys more enjoyable?
Well, it's an idea that's evolved. I don't really probably describe it as gamification anymore. I like to think more in terms of like empathetic survey design, how to build connections with the people you're talking to in the survey, how to make surveys more enjoyable. But the essence of a gamification is essentially this idea that if you can make something fun, people will concentrate more and put more effort into how they do any form of activity, and it's a fantastic motivation framework, and we were able to demonstrate that with loads of experiments when we were taking traditional survey tasks and trying to adding a game-like element to them and seeing the impact it had. And it's a very versatile technique that I've used ever since, and some of the thinking imbues almost every survey I design. There are lots and lots of game-like mechanics that you can invoke to make surveys more interesting. But where we've moved on from that is that it's not gaming is almost like a facet of the process of making a survey enjoyable. There's lots of other ways that you can do that. And there's lots of other things to think about, because it's not just about making it fun. It's about winning the trust of the person, making them, how to motivate them to feel interested in what you're talking about. These are different, slightly different things. The gaming bit is a very specific element of that process, is what I'd say.
I agree. I would describe it as creating an engaging interaction between, the survey and the participant. For example, we can learn a lot from qualitative research, from traditional qualitative research. And for example, using projective techniques into your survey. And sometimes you feel that, when you talk about gamification or it all has to be system one. And in my opinion, a survey has to tap into the whole brain thinking. So combine system one and system two techniques.
So Niels, what do you mean with system one and system two?
Yeah, well, system two thinking is based on thinking fast, thinking slow. And so human beings take, you know, the majority, 80+% of their decisions, they take them, you know, based on an instinct, very fast, which would be survey techniques that go into more of the, you know, like putting people under cognitive pressure or implicit measurement or priming them. You know, or putting something in a context that they don't like a game-like context, they don't necessarily are rationally thinking about the answer and they're responding in speed. I think that's very valid to do it, but in a survey, it's good to combine and also, you know, be able to, sometimes you have to have people think about something. And so if you combine, we call them think, feel, do activities. So you know, make it varied, but because that keeps it engaging. If it's only time pressured or cognitive pressured measurements or only Likert scales, you know, that doesn't work. So it's in the variety. It's in, as John just said, making it fun, an engaging experience. So basically, although it's hard to say, but because a survey is it's pretty transactional by definition, but you almost have to make a rapport, you know, and a relationship if you can for those 5 or max 15 minutes. That's another topic within your survey.
We definitely endorse that point of view. I'm very interested in making a survey reflect the thinking that you're trying to understand, and that might be intuitive, instantaneous choices you might make in the supermarket, but it might be a lot more reflective when you're thinking about making a decision to make a bigger decision. You have a different style of thinking. And so one of my biggest bugbears of traditional research is that we often ask attitudes to try and measure actually potentially behaviors, and respondents really are almost allergic to attitudinal questions these days. The agreement scale is reaching the point where 20% at least of people answering agreement scale questions literally just switch off. And so I'm a big fan of trying to reshape a survey into having sort of allows people to think in their natural ways. I don't say go into a supermarket and rate every single brand and give them a score and then choose. No, you go into a supermarket and you think, I'll have that one. Or you might pick and choose between a couple. You might look at one and look at another, and then you might compare the price, and then you make a reflective choice. Consumers, and then if you can mimic that in the survey experience, it becomes a lot more easier, truthful answers you're getting from people than the sometimes manufactured answers you get by people thinking about things in the wrong way. If you ask people to rate a film, for example, you come out of the cinema, you ask them to rate a film, it takes them about 4 or 5 seconds to give you an answer. But if you said to them as they came out of the survey, the cinema, did you enjoy that film? They can tell you like that, yes or no, which is exactly, all they know is whether they enjoyed it or they didn't enjoy it. So if you understand that, you can get a lot more truthful bit of feedback, instant feedback that's not so meaningless as well. So I think there's a huge link between getting people to think in the right way naturally and enjoying the thinking process as well. And I think that's an important part of entertainment and enjoyment is it has to be plausible for them.
Is doing a survey then also storytelling?
Absolutely, yeah. I it's about them telling their story about their experiences or things like that. And the most successful approaches I've discovered for designing a survey is to build it around a really tight narrative structure, where you're sort of laying out in front of them what you're asking them to do, thinking about a way of getting them interested in doing that thing, and then building the whole survey around them, essentially telling a story about themselves and their experiences. And you can craft a survey with the right you know, structure to do that. And you find that you get a lot more engaged participants if they kind of understand, if you tie things together, coupling questions with other questions, making feel like the response being listened to. So you're referring back to things they might have said in a little survey. You said that you didn't like this. We'd really like to understand why. You know, what is it? You know, you mentioned something about the price. Are there any other things you like the price of? Or, you know, it feels more like a conversation you're having with someone rather than, which is really the great strength of qualitative research, is that it's much more of a conversational experience. And the reason why qualitative research is so effective is because you get so much more out of people. But there are so many of those ideas you can bring into the field of online research by sort of trying to make your survey feel more like a conversation and having a narrative structure.
Yeah, one of the things we've experimented with, for example, is to make a survey modular. So you then have some kind of story components that are built in. And obviously, I mean, it's easier said than done. It's not always possible, but you always have, of course, certain parts of your survey that everybody needs to see and that they need to see in a specific order. But then if you let them choose what other part of the survey to fill out, that gives them a more of a sense of control. And I think one of the future things which is evolving, I believe, for surveys is the AI, the artificial intelligence and bots. From our experiments, we know that people aren't too reluctant about bots. They're also getting more and more experienced with it from an e-commerce perspective. So the bot can't be too good. It still has to be a bot, because otherwise it becomes quite frightening for people. But the massive advantage with a bot is that you can literally build in all these stories and much more even dynamically than, you know, us, you know, predicting a couple of modules and still very static. You know, you're switching the order, but a bot can be more intelligent and to John's point, you know, refer to other parts of the survey that or answers that have been given. And the actual, my vision of it is that if bots become, and survey bots become really very powerful, there will be an opportunity for a huge mashup between what we call quantitative survey research and qualitative research, which is open ends. And the simple reason for that is that a bot doesn't get tired, and you can scale it all over the world. And if it's really intelligent, it can have a conversation. A true conversation with participants.
Yeah, I mean, we're really, really into more, essentially more verbatim driven survey design, where you can see where the bot starts to fit in with AI to understand what, really interpret what people said, and being able to ask smart following questions and so on. What we found, generally speaking, is that, you know, a good open-ended question can replace like 20 closed questions sometimes. And for example, I ask you why you buy your brand of shampoo. If you ask that as an open-ended question, you analyze that, there are easily 100 reasons. Easily. Probably even more than that if you probe. So, you know, commonly what happens in market research is you present people with the shortcut list of the 20 most common things, and then with another option at the bottom. And people can't be bothered to read through like great big long lists, and they randomly click things. The data you get back is just rubbish. And so you ask these constant banks of things like that. And, you know, a simple open-ended question, why did you buy this? And maybe give us three reasons why you bought it. And then using text analytics technology to really interpret that, you get this great big long tail of factors emerging that you can keep track of. You get a richer understanding of the underlying motivations. You can classify and code it in lots of different ways. And where we're going is the bot thought that I can now be highly adaptive of what I then ask next. Because I might say something about the bottle shape. You say, oh, that's interesting. What is it about the bottle shape you like? Or I might say something about the way it lathers in my hand. And do you like how it, you know, what is it? Is it smooth, or is it, you know? And it's interesting, survey design is moving into, it's quite an interesting process to try and think up what follow-on questions you want to ask in these different situations and scenarios. And what you're you're devising navigation paths almost through that process, and I call it sort of Christmas tree branching. So you have a survey with one central question, but a spine of maybe 100 sub clusters of questions following on to dive into particular topics. And you're suddenly moving away from this really long, repetitive, boring survey to something really super tactical, hones in on what they're saying, captures all the extra additional information in a more nuanced way. And you've got something, and if you pitch it to them in the right sort of way, the other things that bots can do now is they can get that they're well beyond just a little cartoon character. They've got, you can actually have like what looks like a human being asking you a question. There's innovation there is just amazing potential, and you can see where it will be in the future. Market research it will be so much more of a hybrid form of quant than the traditional longitudinal study that we all see seem to think of.
And maybe going back, Vera, to your original question, you know, how to make surveys more enjoyable, and John just referred to, you know, long, boring questions. I think that's definitely something we need to all stop doing. Me too. I'm still partly guilty to it.
What would be the ideal length then? That's always a question I get.
Yeah, of course, it depends on your information needs. Personally, we try to strive for surveys that are not longer than 12 minutes or 15 minutes in length. If we can make it shorter, that's better. But if you look at some brand trackers or UNA, ANU, attitude and usage studies, some of them are 35, 40 minutes long, which is really, really, really detrimental. So that's...
I've got a different answer to that.
Yeah.
You would never ask me how long should a film be or a television series. I would say, how interesting is it? Because you can get 10 minutes into watching a boring film and you switch off. But, you know, some of the techniques we've been playing around with, one of the things I really like to do is to create like a quiz at the end of a survey. Say, so you've done, I'm working on one right now. You're doing a survey, I can't tell you. At the end of the survey, when they've got all that sort of standard information, we say, well, test your knowledge of this topic. And you make a quiz. And I've turned it to level game. So if you do really well at it, you get to the next level. People play games for hours. And I've developed what most of the survey games that can go on a lot longer if you get it in the right way. So, this idea of length. If you look at, I've done a lot of work when you analyze dropout and look at survey length. And yeah, the longer the survey, the more people will drop out. There's a point, a rule of thumb that you're going to lose a third of a percent of your sample for every minute of your survey. That's a dropout rate. So after 3 minutes, you will lose 1%, 2%, 3%. So. If you actually look at a whole load of studies, the dropout rate is like that. And the design-dependent variable compared to the length-dependent variable is an order of magnitude larger, i.e. I can have a survey that's 12 minutes long that half of people drop out because it's so boring. I can have a perfectly designed survey that people concentrate on for 30 minutes that no one drops out of because they're engaged in it. So length is not the right question. It's how interesting is that survey? How many people are getting to the end of it and feeling like they've enjoyed themselves and you know, want to carry on? One of the things that I measure the performance of a survey is ask people to do an extra bit at the end. And the very number of people who volunteer to do it is a proxy indication of how much they've enjoyed the experience up until that point. And you can move from a figure of 20, 30% up to 90% simply on design narrative, how you've done it, how much you've engaged it, how interesting experiences. And those are sorts of metrics that I think we should move to when evaluating a survey. It's about, did you enjoy this? Would you like to do another survey like this again in the future? Will you like to do the next survey we're about to send on this topic? And I mean, I must say, they're absolute masters at this idea of having long-term relationships with their with their consumers. They create panels, and the whole point of what they have to do is keep them coming back. And so the onus is making the experience enjoyable enough to earn their trust to come back and do it again. And so I think that, you know, Insight's done some really interesting things in the way that they've approached a panelist in terms of the mindset. We tend to treat panelists as these stupid people asking them really dumb questions like, what is your favorite color? And then you find out it's actually to find out you're a car manufacturer. You want to know what color car to paint your next car. And everyone comes back and says it's pink. And so you're not going to paint your car pink. But if you treat the respondent as an intelligent person saying, look, we're trying to design a new shade of color for our car. Which color would you choose? You brought them into the problem you're trying to solve and you get the right answer. And I think that, I'll leave it to Neil to describe some things they've been doing in that space, but they're really interesting things, treating their panelists like consultants.
Yeah, and that's, of course, when you are in a more community setting panel, you're more into a longitudinal game. So your survey now determines your response for the next one. And we've seen massive dropouts when it's a really long survey, not engaging, very difficult. The next survey, the response rate, even your dropout rate on that bad survey, so to speak, may be reasonable. The next one, the response rate to start with is much lower. So depending on whether you're in a more longitudinal setting, or not, that definitely is detrimental or not. I fully agree with what John said. You can, you know, you can't make people do boring things. So even if it's 5 minutes, that's hard. But in my experience, I've never seen a survey that's really compelling that lasts, you know, 30 to 40 minutes. Even though people play games, in my opinion, and I'm trying to be very honest, is I'm not a game designer. There's many more other games that, you know, are there to be played that are more fun than filling out surveys. But I agree with John too. We've done that too, giving people a choice to continue and to do another part. And like if you do, I don't know, pack design test or advertising tests, and you say we've got another one. Would you want to do a similar one? You don't have to. We can stop here. But then, yes, over 30% will do that. And that's quote unquote free sample, or not something you expected to have. I think in the approach, Vera, another important aspect now these days, and well, it's been going on longer, but it's became much more widespread, is mobile. So we tend to forget that, let's say about 5 to 8 years ago, it would be 20% of the people coming on a regular survey would be on mobile. Now it's over 50%. And then certain cohorts of, you know, demographics, youngsters, it's over 80, even 90%. And that real estate on a tablet or on a mobile, even if you have a larger screen, it's not less. A lot of the surveys we design are not compatible with that environment. Think of a Likert scale. It's very hard to do on that real estate. So I think in a way to summarize it, we should also adapt our surveys to fit people's lives and their behaviors. And part of that, you know, people are on their mobile phone all the time. So our surveys, not only in terms of length or engaging, but also in terms of the measurement methods and the scales that we use, should be adapted to that mental as well as behavioral process. So I, you know, I'm academically also trained. And so, you know, your Likert scale should be ideally 7 points and, you know, all that other thing, because we want a lot of variation in the data. And that's still true. But the reality is that you can't really measure that on a mobile. So we will rather use things like swiping left and right, because, well, people are on Tinder or they tend to make these decisions very fast. And yes, that's a binary, a binary data point. But there's data analytics software and tools now enough to even, you know, make sure that that's useful. And especially it's because you have to balance it with the fact that people are on a mobile. So, grids and scales are becoming much more difficult to use from that perspective.
We we've been looking at accelerometers on the swiping process just to measure a degree of emotional connection with a point, with the thought that people can swipe more aggressively if they really agree with it and things like that. So they're sort of injecting their emotion into how they answer the question. I really like that idea. You know, it's a question mark whether it actually reveals that point. But I think that the how we're evolving to use a mobile phone for survey, it does require an awful lot of thinking. Yeah, because the traditional Likert scale just simply doesn't fit on a mobile phone screen. 7-point scale, you'll find, early days of market research, moving to online, we found all of our strongly agreed disappeared because that was the bottom choice and it was below the, it's like you have to change the design of the question. But in terms of, I mean, in terms of engagement of people on mobile phones, I think the challenges you face are even hyperly more significant because a great majority, I'm afraid to say, of people doing a survey on a mobile, a second screening in front of the television. And so you can see it. You can actually see it, the spikes in answer time coinciding with a 15-minute ad break. you know, or they'll do a little cluster of questions and then get distracted. And then they don't come back again. And so the dropout rate on surveys on a mobile is naturally higher, around about, on average, about 5 or 10% higher. And you can't avoid that. But so the challenges of engagement become even more important. And I think that that involves keeping it visually simple, clear. I mean, I'm a really big advocate of visuals in surveys, utilizing them in really clean ways, you know, optimal ways, utilizing all the space availability, thinking about separating out the story you want to tell from the question. So quite often you have this question, which is a great big run of text, and then you have the actual option choices hanging beneath off the screen. And so, you know, just simple things like, I've got something I want to tell to this audience. What have I got to say? I've got like 4 sentences here. So what I would commonly do is I break that out into each sentence with a picture to explain each thing, a bit like a any form of communication. They click next, the next sentence come along. So you're briefing them in a monadic way. I got the job, then you ask them the question. So you're ensuring that they've read what you're asking them to do, and you're using the visuals and the way that you use the visuals to draw people in to want to do it. So, you know, I think that those are sorts of techniques. So thinking about the question that you ask as an advert, and how do you sell this question to the person? How do you make them want to think about answering it? So I think we talked about this last time, but I could ask you to rate how much you like different types of television programs, or I could present with you a television screen with fuzzy things, and I click a button and you know, something appears on it, and I say, right, imagine you could design your perfect television channel just showing the stuff you wanted to watch. What would you show? Now I've introduced this idea of you, I'm now in charge of choosing what I want to watch. What would I want? Now I instantly, I've up the ante for that person to answer it. They're more interested and engaged, and you get richer answers. And the options you present to people can be in that same language. So you, instead of saying rating it, you say, well, I quite like to have this on. This is a must-have sort of thing. So it's sort of like they have an emotional reaction to, you know, why they want it or not. I definitely don't want that. Or, you know, I ban this or something. You know, so that you're getting them to engage their feelings to answer it in a more interesting, you know, and you get just more truthful answers out of people that way. Yeah. So I've said a lot of things there, but it's a sort of, it's a combination of thinking of ergonomics, emotional engagement, and then the tasks. Niels, the thing I was thinking about was that I remember your company did a really interesting thing where you essentially asked people to do some really detailed analysis of deconstructing a piece of communication and telling us what they, you know, and then getting them to pick other people's thoughtful comments, which was the best piece of advice, really upping, that's what I found, upping the game in making people, asking them really a lot smarter questions can really, actually people find that genuinely interesting to do. If you can ask them a really challenging, interesting question, like solving a puzzle and getting them to help you solve it, I found that a tremendous success with Take Me.
Yeah, we've used techniques like showing pictures of other participants, and then ask people to analyze what they see from a picture. So it could be ethnographical, how people use ketchup on a dish, and you show them dishes. You ask them to analyze that picture, and you ask them to tell you what they see, but also tell you what they don't see, what they think is weird, what they think is interesting. And so you get a really rich description of those elements. Another thing that we've used is what we call result sharing. So you ask people a like or a dislike of an advertisement or a pack or whatever it is. You ask them a rating scale. And instead of asking them, what is it that you like or dislike, you show them saying, hey, 18% of the people like you responded to this, that responded to the survey, gave this design or this pack a 2 or less out of 5, right? Why do you think, even if you gave it a 4, why do you think that people would give it a 2 or less? Instead of asking the dislikes, you kind of put them in a context and you share the results and the findings. We call it crowd interpretation, and it's powerful because you create this, again, this direct connection between what you ask them and what people do and what people tell you. So you make it kind of interactive. You make it relevant, basically, for people because they recognize those elements. And then and the second thing you realize is that it's also rewarding because you're giving them back. I feel that when you go back to that original question, how to make surveys more enjoyable, is that we need to play much more on the intrinsic motivation of why people participate. And people participate because they think it's interesting and because they want to learn something. And also they want to help a brand or they want to help a cause. But if they learn something as well, and if they see, oh, this is what others do, or wait a minute, they already processed, you know, some of my responses. That's really rewarding for participants. And it makes them, or it gives them also a feeling, you know, that what they tell you is something is done with that. Like, especially on the communities, if you are back again in that longitudinal setting, if you, you know, say previously, you know, we learned this and this is what the company decided to do, and then you have another survey on that topic, people are feeling that, you know, like a product concept has evolved, it has improved, and so they understand or they realize that you're basically using them as consultants. So that's if you can give people that feeling in a survey or in multiple surveys, that's really helpful, because then you're using them as your extended brain in a way, and they are just a voice, consumers as consultants, is the idea behind it.
We've taken that up right up to the top with exactly that same technique with a doctor survey. We won an MRS Healthcare Research Award for this. We got a corpus of 10 doctors to fill out a questionnaire about how they would treat people with a particular type of cancer. Okay, quite a serious topic, really quite a serious topic. And then what we did is we designed the whole survey for all the other doctors around what these 10 doctors said. So we then asked them, a doctor, well, what would you do in this circumstance? And what do you think these 10 doctors would do? And when they gave the same answers to 10 doctors, you'd say, oh, that's interesting. Everyone else is going to do that. Why do you think they would do that? And you'd ask, but the most valuable insight was when they gave an answer was different to those 10 doctors. Why are you doing something different to these other 10 doctors? That's critically valuable information. And what we asked them feedback about it, and every single doctor said exactly the same thing. This was the most interesting survey they'd ever done because they were learning about what other people would do in these really difficult, challenging decision-making frameworks. And could all surveys be like that? It's like, and I've used that thinking so often in survey design. I mean, exactly that. Mirror back what they say, challenging them to explain why they might disagree or agree with the corpus. Any form of feedback you can give to people, I think people find useful or encouraging. And it's such an important weapon. I mean, it's obviously difficult to think about doing that for an everyday piece of research, but anything of a certain larger scale is really critically valuable. You know, we do a diary study where I'm trying to recruit people into reporting on what they drink. And so to get them in is really, you know, we want to get them to participate. So we designed this wonderful recruitment study that is a drink personality test. And as you answer it, we tell you what your palate's like compared to other people and what your, you know, you're a fizzy type of person versus you're a hot drink or a cold drink person. It's fairly simple bits of feedback. At the end of it, we give them a little personality pin. And then we say, would you like, did you find that interesting? Would you like to, you know, do this the next 7 days, report back on what? And we... literally adding those bits of feedback, we went from 75% of people saying yes to like approaching 89 or something. Just ratcheted up people's, you're giving them back, making it interesting. I think all those techniques are tremendously valuable.
What do you think about using humor in surveys? Because does that scare people off or do you sometimes use it?
Oh, I've got loads of stories about that. I'm really big fan. Humor is a really, really... one of the challenges you face in surveys is really trying to raise people's self-awareness. And because so often people casually exaggerate or are embarrassed to say something, particularly about certain topic areas. We tend to overclaim or underclaim. You know, I'm embarrassed to admit that I might smoke. And the sustainability is probably the key area we find that we've got a massive amount of overclaim. So we got this brilliant example of this woman. It's a video, it's a jokey one of those meme videos, this woman trying to throw a bag of rubbish in the bin. And as she throws it, she swings it, and it scatters everywhere. And you cannot help but laugh. She's got a dressing gown on, a bit ill-fitting. And you laugh. And the punchline is, look, you know, what I'm doing is normalizing errant behavior, making feel comfortable admitting to something that is embarrassing or not, you know, not maybe, you know, socially acceptable. You follow that with a question to say, okay, come on, admit it. Do you actually recycle regularly? The number of people that go from admitting it and with and without that, you go from zero, literally zero, 1% of people will admit to not recycling in a traditional survey to around about a third. And so humor as a weapon to normalize errant behavior is something we use. At the beginning of our surveys, we have a process called honesty priming. And I've got a wonderful picture of some dogs lying on a beach and the same dogs doing something else, like by the Egyptian pyramids. They do all these fancy things. And we say, you know, don't you get pissed off with the people on Facebook showing off about their lives? We actually want to know what your real life is like. And then you have a picture of a bloke sitting on a sofa or something, watching television with some, we're trying to humanize everyone's lives and make them feel comfortable to tell us to reveal their truths. Wow, it can be effective. I love that type of approach. It sometimes requires a bit of care because you can, you know, steer things off a bit. But yeah, big fan of it in the right way. Answer.
Yeah, great. I haven't done it, so John, you that's awesome. But I'm sure if you can find the right context, if it's relevant for a specific topic, then it breaks the ice and it makes people feel comfortable, and then they provide the answers that you want and need.
We use that grumpy cat meme a lot. You know, just say, you know, sometimes it's a bit difficult to actually really recognize how you're feeling about something, but we, you know, have a go.
One thing, it's not humor, but it's similar. It's about, you know, that relevance, again, is that we're also seeing new triggers for surveys. So traditionally, you know, we have a database and we send out a survey link. But if you have in the moment triggers, like a QR code, for example, on a pack, we use it for Nestle and people, it's on a pack, it's a new SKU that's being launched, people scan it, you get linked to a survey. You ask a couple of questions on why did you buy it, where did you buy it, was it the first time you bought it? And then if people opt in, they get a follow-up survey 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later, 4 weeks later. Have you bought it again? What's your satisfaction, et cetera, et cetera. So that's trigger-based surveying, you know, like on a QR code. Another one is geolocation. So we do that a lot for Sky Priority, and we track touch points in many airports around the world with among Sky Priority members. And so they have to, through their mobile, they evaluate their check-in, for example. And it's simple. Are you treated a Sky Priority customer? Yes or no? Give an NPS score, and then you can upload a picture. And that picture provides a lot of context to yes or no, I've been treated as a Sky Priority customer. So you see a huge line, and it's very actual these days with all the, you know, hassles at airports and stuff like that. But that's in the moment. That's both of those examples are very relevant, very contextual surveys, and people like to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good example of like basically saying it's all about context.
Yeah.
You know, the relevance of, I'd feel happy to give a bit of feedback if I'm walking through the airport and I want to, or if I'm feeling cross, I get that little press, that little button. It's relevant to give feedback at that point of time. But often in a survey sent to people blind, well, it's like, you know, that port flight I made 2 weeks ago, I don't care anymore. And so it's an effort to me to remember, but doing something in a relevant, timely way transformed the experience for someone being frustrating to having to do it to being actually important. And that the motivation is completely different. And a lot of the time when I'm designing surveys, I'm trying to work out how to make it back important again to them emotionally. And from that, then they find it more relevant, and therefore they'll put more effort into doing it and find it more interesting.
And if it's more relevant, those may be people that would, if you would ask them, would you participate in research, they would say no.
No.
But because it's so relevant, because they're having an experience, it all of a sudden changes and people do participate.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the critical point in any survey in this topic area of engagement is the first question. And so often I see these first questions, which is often like three paragraph disclaimer. Then you know no one's going to read, and it's just off-putting. Or they'll prevent you from going to list tick list of things they want you to find out about you, and it's in it, from a sort of like conceptual point of view, it's incredibly narcissistic. This is what I want to know. I'm not really thinking about you, and so whenever I design a survey, I'm always trying to think, well, how do I introduce this topic? How do I think of an entry point? So I'm doing a survey about shampoo. How do I draw people in to want to even open their minds to talk about it? So I might, I mean, it's quite simple. The techniques to do that, it can be really quite simple. Just a good question, like, what is the secret of a perfect shampoo? Conjures up, I read that and I think, well, what is the secret? I know what the survey is going to be about. That sounds interesting. You know, I'm gonna click the next button, and so that's. I think that if you can enter a survey with that mindset, whenever you're designing a survey, thinking that, well, what is the first question? What is my elevator pitch for this survey experience to the consumer? Sometimes you have to be careful not to lead people because, you know, I don't want to draw people into doing something about a topic that, you know, then they say, well, have you bought a BMW car recently? People are going to say yes. So, but that aside, I think that idea of initial engagement, warming them in, thinking about opening them up, it's a bit like, you know, walking up to someone at a party. with a clipboard, you know, they're not necessarily going to be want to be your best mate. You know, sort of like you have an icebreaker. Qualitative researchers would never think about jumping straight in. They would want to get to know you. And so, you know, we forget about all this when we're designing a survey. All we ever think about is, what do I want to know? What do I want to know? Rather than thinking outwards towards this, how do you get this person to tell you what you want to know?
If I would give you an enormous bag of money, what type of research would you conduct then?
Good question.
You go first, John.
The problem is that I can do free research. And I think, I mean, so it's been really I can wake up in the morning and have an idea and do a piece of research. So it's not a very good question to ask me. But what am I? I mean, I do that every day. I get given an enormous bag of virtual money there is definitely.
So let me phrase it differently. So what would be your next project? Or do you want to not share?
What am I most interested in doing research on? I'm really interested in the linguistic open-ended. I've set up the Kantar Issues Barometer, which is a global study. We asked 10,000 people around the world in 20 different countries a set of questions, just all open-ended, to understand what's happening in their world and analyzing that back. And it's just fantastic. So I am trying to set up an ongoing linguistic tracker to map consumption, behavior, and motivations. That's my interesting thought, that we could do, you know, understanding on an ongoing basis why people are making consumer decisions, filling that gap between like search and you know, people go and buy things, they look for things, but why? I'm really interested in that why bit.
Yeah, for me, it would be that mashup with what I call in market, in context measurement, trigger based, with AI bots, and so the mashup of qual and quant, which partly cover, you know, touches upon what John also says, because a lot of open ended questions would be, you know, feeding into that, so anything in that area. Because I also think that language, if it's open-ended questions, it has a cultural dimension to it. So understanding that piece of it on a scaled massive base, that's like my ideal for the future coming together. Haven't done it, so but that would be the elements I would compose. So scaled open-ended questions with bots in the moment and cultural analysis around it. That's I think something that's very intriguing and could be very enriching.
Yeah, I agree. And what about you then?
Yeah, that is a very difficult question, because I come from a different field now, because I work at Statistics Netherlands, and we have very different types of surveys that you are working on. Mm-hmm. So we have like this fixed enormous questionnaires where I would be happy if we can design them mobile first, actually. There is a large difference between what I would do when it comes to doing research for Statistics Netherlands and what I would do like in general.
I take that. I take your point seriously that a lot of the stuff we've been talking about is very easy for us to sort of extol, because we're working in a less constrained field. But I do appreciate the challenges of doing some quite serious pieces of, you know, government style research, and I've worked on a few of those types of projects, and it often boils down to ergonomics, but I do feel there's still a lot of room in those types of studies for better narrative, B, working out actually the value of certain questions and trying to be optimal in the types of questions you ask, the routing and And then the linking up of content, I think, is really useful to improve the concentration and how you tie everything together. It may not be so glamorous, but to try and think of how do you make, say, a serve about government transport policy or something, how do you make that interesting? There is still, I've never seen a survey, there isn't a room for a really great intro page.
Yes, for sure, for sure. Actually, we are working on that as we speak.
Good.
Yeah. Well, I think our time is up. Thank you so much for doing it with me. I think we can talk for hours, and maybe we should do that at a different point in time. But for now, I would like to thank you and wish you all the best.
Our pleasure. It's our pleasure. Thank you.
Same here. My pleasure, Vera.
Bye-bye.
Good to see you again, John.
All right. Good to see you too. Yeah. All right. See you at SMR Congress, an advert.